Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
I was just asking, I know that you have talked to Mustafa a couple of times, but this is our first time to talk. And like I said, the last time, you are one of my personal heroes, because I'm also I'm an ex-Muslim from Egypt, and I have political asylum here in Sweden because of leaving and criticizing Islam. So you were like a huge inspiration for me. And your book, Infidel, is one of my all-time favorites.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. And it's lovely to meet you. And again, I congratulate you on your journey. I think for me, I call it a journey to enlightenment. So congratulations.
Thanks, Ayan.
So Ayan, your new book is called Pray. Can you talk about that, and why do you call it Pray?
I call it Pray because of so the book describes the behavior of some men, obviously not all, and some of these men are from countries where women are divided into good women and bad women, those who are modest and those who are immodest, the chaste and the unchaste, and so on. And the women who are considered to be living outside of this moral code, I call it the modesty doctrine, those women are considered to be prey. And that's why I gave the name, the title, why I chose the title Prey, because it accurately describes not just the behavior towards women that these men display, but their attitude towards those women that they consider to be outside of the protection of the moral code.
And would you say, in your opinion, this is something that is more related to Islam or more related to cultural norms, or a combination of both?
It's a combination of both. So what I see is, when Islam becomes relevant, for instance, you would have some of the authorities in European countries or in Western countries reach out to religious leaders, imams, and other people who have religious influence. And they will then in turn say, well, the women should not be in places, or they should not be dressed in ways that puts themselves in trouble. That's, I think, where Islam becomes relevant. And the honor code, the modesty doctrine, it does have some aspects that have religious underpinnings But a lot of it is also cultural, and people will say, historians will say, that that honor code actually predates Islam, and you also see it in communities that are not Islamic but are tribal.
Do you think that your way of talking about these issues has changed from your time in Netherlands to now? So, for example, I can notice that you speak in a more like different tone and more nuanced. And like before, I noticed that you were talking more about Islam, and now you're talking like Islam as one element, and you're also talking about clan and values. Do you recognize that?
That change, in I'll say there are two things there. One, yes, I have changed in the ways that I describe, and I take, I have more patience. I take more time to say things that, you know, about 20 years ago, I thought they were obvious. For instance, it's obvious to me that not all Muslim men engage in sexual misconduct or violence against women. And so in the past, I didn't think that it was necessary to keep on stating the obvious. Now I believe that it is important to keep on stating the obvious that way. But the other aspect, I would say, is not perhaps that I have changed as much as it is, as you know, these topics are really, really controversial and people get truly upset. And so there was an image of me in the media that I was strident and uncompromising and had no nuance for things. And I think that now that these problems are growing as the numbers of immigrants grow, as the issue of integration becomes a bigger problem, that people are seeing people who thought, who had never met me and who had never spoken to me, who thought that I wasn't being nuanced, are now seeing, oh, it's not really me who is the problem, or others like you, by the way, who raise these issues. But we have very serious problems that we need to be talking about. And to a certain degree, I think it's very difficult to find a way to talk about these problems without upsetting some people.
Yeah, and I do recognize what you are saying, because I think when I started to speak about these issues in the beginning, I think I had a more black and white approach. And I have seen your journey during the years, and I have actually been pretty impressed by your, for example, seeing you talking to a person like Majid Nawaz. Do you think that has some effect on you, on how you talk about the issues?
Well, yeah, I'll say the one aspect where I have publicly said I have changed my mind. This is, I mean, I give an account of it in my book, Heretic, Why Islam Needs a Reformation. And I would say perhaps it's because I had conversations with people like Majid and others, other Muslims. You know, I have Muslim friends. Some of them are, they still identify as Muslim. Some of them are ex-Muslims. But what became very clear to me over the years, let's say the years between 2010, that's when I published my book, Nomad, and 2015, and that's when I published Heretic. In that period, when I wrote Nomad, I had a chapter in there saying, it's hopeless. If you're a good person and you're a Muslim, you know, you're reduced to a life of cognitive dissonance. And so the best escape, the best way out was to leave Islam altogether. And if you then want to remain religious, you know, maybe you should convert to Christianity or some other religion, but Islam is not the answer. And by 2015, I had spoken to enough to a number of Muslims who are not ready to leave Islam, because for them, Islam wasn't just what Allah says and what Muhammad has prescribed. It was a way, it's a culture, it's their food, it's their background, it's their identity. And so the conversations I was having, I had moved on from, okay, you need to abandon your background altogether, to maybe there is a way that you can find to reform Islam. And then that is then what led to the questions that I ask in the book Heretic. Majid Nawaz, he is a wonderful friend and very inspirational. But I think I had made this transition before I had spoken to Majid. In fact, I think that my friendship with Majid was possible because I had mellowed in this way, if that's what you want to call it, yeah.
I like in this conversation also how Mustafa's Swedishness is coming out, because basically he couldn't directly ask the question if your views on Islam has changed. to go back to pray, Ayan, and the cultural attitudes towards women and sexuality and so on. This is something that I myself can relate to a lot, because I haven't been in Sweden for a long time. I've been here only for 7 years. And I was deeply religious and even I had like a very, let's say, unhealthy view of women and sexuality in general. And sometimes even in my teenage years, me and my friends, we harassed women in Cairo and so on. But I'm interested also in, because sometimes people say, well, in Islam, all these things about harassment and rape and all that is forbidden. It's haram. I have like an analysis that I want to run by you, because for me, and this is what I was experiencing as well, this kind of sexual puritanism, sexual repression that exists in Islam creates some kind of inner conflict, because at one point you're supposed to be to abstain from sexual relationships, even not to like look at women with lust and so on. It's haram, but at the same time the desire exists, and this creates this inner conflict that I think in a way translates also into an aggressive behavior. Like when I was like listening also to what happened with them, I can't remember her name, the reporter in Tahrir Square, Lara Logan, mm-hmm. What happened to her and how she was describing that they were pulling at her scalp and head and muscles in a very violent way. And I could understand that, because for me, this is a part of this aggression resulting from the sexual repression in religion. Do you think there is something there?
I think the what you described just now was also described in almost the exact same words by the Algerian French writer Kamel Daoud, where he says we have a problem in the Arab Muslim world. And yes, part of that is absolutely religious. The insistence on puritanism, on abstinence, the separation of men and women. Actually, it starts, you could say, boys and girls, because it's in some households that starts as young as when the boys are only 7 years old. And then they're relegated to the realm of the men. And then the women, the girls, they're getting, it used to be that when they hit puberty, that's when they were required to dress modestly, meaning wear the headscarf and so on. But because of the rise of movements like the Muslim Brotherhood, it's become, you know, you see 3-year-olds and 4-year-old girls in tight headscarves. And so does religion, does Islam have anything to do with this? Yes, I think it lies at the basis of it. When, again, to go to Mustafa's nuance, if you think of Islam as sort of the governing doctrine, where the rules have their basis, then yes, this Puritanism has as its foundation Islam. But I think even for those people, because that's where it starts to become problematic, some of these young men who engage in the behavior you described, taharrush, this harassing and really violent behavior against women, and a complete disregard for female humanity, no remorse whatsoever after they've committed these acts, and no empathy for the victim that they're treating in that way. Some of these individuals are not religious at all. They probably can barely read the Quran. They almost never pray. And so I think there you have a combination of Islam as determining, well, here's what good girls look like, and here are the bad ones. And then on a cultural level, but not religious, young men behaving, violently towards women. And the two reinforce one another. When the men are reprimanded, when they're asked, why do you behave in this way? If they go to the mosque and, they take their wudu, that is the ablutions, and so they can purify themselves of this sin. But because the restrictions that you describe between the sexes are not lifted, this young man is just not, the ablution and the praying and asking for forgiveness for a day or two, or maybe during the month of Ramadan, that doesn't resolve the problem, because his desire doesn't go away, and he has no clue how to have a healthy relationship with a female.
Exactly. And it's also, it's interesting to look at countries that have gender segregation, whether enforced or as a norm, they tend to also have higher rates of sexual violence in general. And that is also understandable, because growing up in a gender segregated society, I think you, like, for example, when I was in a gender segregated school, and I remember, for example, when a girl would be passing by in the street, like all of us boys in the class would go to the window and we'd like start like, shouting at that girl and things like that. And then when you are then brought into contact with a woman, both the man and the woman understand that the reason they were kept away from each other is because of sex. So it's very difficult to have a non-sexualized interaction because the man is thinking, here is that woman that they were keeping me away from. And the woman is thinking, oh, this is the guy, the dangerous guy who was I was being protected from. And both of them are just like thinking about the whole context is sexualized.
Yes, the only relationship, and this again, I have to agree with Ashkan, is Islamic. The only relationship possible between men and women is sexual, and then what happens if you really go through the Sharia rules that govern the relationship between men and women, is it goes into such detail that you can only associate with your mother, your sister, and so on in a non-sexual way. Mm-hmm. Beyond these really teeny tiny number of small of relatives, all other women to you are sexual. That is in Sharia law. That is basically in the Quran. And then how then people... communities that are sometimes Muslim in name and sometimes quite serious about Sharia law, how they put that into practice is different, I would say, from community to community, probably from household to household. But in the Middle East, among Arabs, it's pretty extreme in the sense that it's almost impossible to have a friendship between a man and a woman that it is so radically sexualized. And some of the really very good and honest observers say an Arab man has sex on his mind all the time because it is the one thing he can't have. And then, and for the Arab woman, it's also some of these descriptions that I've read a few autobiographies on that. It's the same case. You can't think of a man without thinking about sex. Now, I agree with you wholeheartedly that that is a very unhealthy, extremely unhealthy way of, you know, of organizing a society. And this is what's holding Arab Muslim countries back, because there's just this extremely unhealthy relationship between girls and boys, men and women. And there are enough girls and enough boys and enough men and women who see this and who have written about it and commented on it and have tried to make changes. And I wonder, this is something I would like to ask you, since you've only been there recently. These attempts at change, do you think that they have had any impact? And if you, what happens if you compare the impact of these? Let me just describe it as a modernizing way, the modernization of the relationship between men and women in the Middle East. If you compare it to the impact that the Muslim Brotherhood has had, let's call it, I don't know, I want to call it the Islamization or the Brotherhoodization. I'm looking for a way of describing it. So which one do you think has had more impact? I ask you this question because I see some of the initiatives that the Gulf Arab countries are taking now. In Saudi Arabia, saying to the virtue and vice police that they no longer have a role to play, allowing concerts where men and women will interact. The UAE has also made some attempts in trying to modernize in this way. Egyptians have always been, within that world, I would say, the most advanced until the rise and success of the Muslim Brotherhood. But is this, are we going forward? Is the modernization happening? Or is in the impact of the Islamists keeping everyone back?
I would say, to me, it appears that it's very much a generational question. Like in Egypt, you can see a very clear distinction even between like people, like the young people born in the 90s and those born in the 80s. And the internet has really played a major role there. So the 90s generation is definitely more liberal and less religious compared to the previous generations. But the problem also that there can be some kind of like, again, an inner conflict that even in liberalization, because the thing is, there is a liberalization between the relationship between men and women, yes, in the younger generations. However, sexual relationships are still a very strict taboo. So, for example, you can associate with somebody, but you cannot really have a romantic or sexual partner, which becomes also somewhat disturbing, I would say, if you're not able to have a normal love life or sexual life that is outside of marriage, especially since marriage is it's very costly. There's a lot of people in Egypt that can't afford marriage because of the dowry and so on. So there becomes a conflict there. Go on, Ayan.
Yeah, I think it's more than a conflict. I think it becomes more and more complex. I remember in the middle of the 1980s, there was this resurgence of Islam and this rejection of other forms of isms, you know, socialism and liberalism and all that was being rejected, and people wanted to live by the rules of Islam. And this was voluntary. This wasn't some kind of outside force imposing it on communities. It was a bottom-up kind of movement. And back then, it was literally the constant problem, which was, well, then what do you do about these relations between men and women? And it seemed to me as if whether they were Sunni Muslims or Shia Muslims, they found a solution in saying that girls should be married off as early as possible so that a young woman has her first period in her husband's house. And this was seen as a solution to this problem that you're describing. There was no need, therefore, because it was seen any kind of sex outside of marriage, and not even sex, just the hint at it, you know, young women making themselves attractive, going out to the movies, you know, having a romantic relationship, even without sleeping with the man, even that was seen as a big problem. And so the only solution then had to be marriage. And then I remember that there was this reversal where my mother's generation had more freedoms almost in and were allowed to get to, you know, beyond puberty, get to age 18, 19, 20 before they were married off. And in the mid 80s and later, girls were being married off at 13, 14, 15. And then when I came to the Netherlands in 1992, I saw the same phenomenon. And this is now among Moroccans and Turks and other North Africans, but also equally refugees from Iraq and Afghanistan, many Somalis. So I wonder what the internet has done to that dynamic.
I would say from where I stand, I think the internet has really is pushing towards more liberalization and secularism. This is why sometimes I can also be a bit more skeptical of calls to reform Islam, because I think if anything, the move should be more towards secularism than towards a closer relationship to a watered down religion that dictates the aspects of every single aspect of one's life. But I am curious also, like, when it comes to, let's say, the integration of Sweden has now, it's one of the countries that has the highest percentage of foreign-born population in Europe, is like around 20% now. But there hasn't been enough talk, I would say, about reforming the relationship between the sexes from an integration and migration point of view, because I think a lot of people really are missing that in the Middle East and many countries in Africa and so on, men there are not used to this courtship and dating and so on. So quite often there's just like arranged marriages and so on. But now they are faced with a totally different kind of lifestyle and relationship between the sexes. And I think for many of them, they don't really know how to approach it. They actually don't know how to build a relationship or approach a woman in a Western context. And also the idea of consent was totally absent in the Middle East. And quite often how people, like men in the Middle East, that was including myself as well when I was growing up there. My view of Western women was something like this, like you make the dichotomy between chaste women and immodest women. It was the same for me. So I would say that I viewed Western women as unchaste or extremely promiscuous to the degree that they are sexually indiscriminate. And in that sense, there is implied consent that they are giving to everybody. So there wasn't even a question whether this like woman wants to be with me or not, if you understand what I mean.
Oh, I understand what you mean, and I appreciate your honesty. You actually, I think I'm speechless, because there are very few people, especially very few men, who will come out and say these things on the record that you're saying now. So I think what you're doing now is, the three of you, really amazing. And I honestly think it's in conversations like this that can trigger the kind of honesty that we need in terms of trying to achieve change. I want to respond first by saying, in the European societies, their attitudes towards immigrants and even the language that's used to describe, such as immigrant or asylum seeker, refugee, I think there is this, it's almost as if the leadership of these societies are determined to stay away from all things cultural and religious. So let me just park that one there, and we can unpack it later and come back to it.
I maybe forgot also to introduce myself. I'm Omar, and Ashkan he came into the room now.
Hi, Ayan. I was in another meeting. I couldn't cancel.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Yeah.
Omar, I kept calling you Ashkan because that's what it says on my screen. I'm very sorry.
No worries.
Yeah, I had a question regarding the UAE and similar countries toning down a little bit their restrictions in terms of, you know, Islamic scripture. I was wondering if you have some thoughts on what incentivizes them to do this, because I see the same thing happening in Iran, where I come from, that the government is becoming a little bit more, you know, lax when it comes to Islamic laws, especially with regards to women.
I think the primary reason is it's the economy. I think some of these countries that rely purely on oil are now realizing, or have realized for a number of at least a decade, that can't possibly be a way for them to go forward economically. And so some of these leaders were educated in Europe, in the US, and they have reached the conclusion that they need to open their economies up to the rest of the world. And by doing so in the information age, that requires, I think they fully understand that they need to make some changes and maybe move away from Sharia law. And some of them will say modernizing the economy is completely in sync with Sharia. And it doesn't matter whether they say it that way or whether they admit openly that it's Sharia law is a relic from the past. But regardless, this is a positive unintended consequence.
So you don't think they necessarily have to code these changes into some kind of Islamic wording? Is that completely arbitrary?
A country like Iran, the Iranian regime codes everything. They code everything, shout everything in Islamist lingo. But I think in countries like the UAE right now, that's where you see change at its fastest happening. I think they've completely dropped. I've heard some of them say, how you practice Islam is a personal thing. And then the banning of the Muslim Brotherhood and, you know, the cracking down on Islamists. In Saudi Arabia, the latest has been, bringing down the morality police, but also withholding funding from, I don't know if I say the word al-waqf, I think that you understand what it means, but how do we translate into English these charitable endowments that were, given to countries across the world to, you know, radicalize, let me just call it Wahhabize societies as far as Indonesia and parts of Africa. These endowments have now been curtailed, if not stopped. So you can see now some of these policies are actually towards modernization. But these are things that take a long time. And I don't know if ever the problem between men and women is going to be addressed. The sexual problem that you describe is something that any government will be able to do anything about. If governments enforce the rule of law and if they change their laws in the Arab countries to punish perpetrators of sexual misconduct, that, you know, that's up to a point, but the real change has to be, it has to happen in the schools. It has to happen, as you said, over the internet. And I have a word or two to say about the internet, but it's going to be a cultural bottom-up shift. And I don't see how governments can force these things in between, you know, the Kemal Ataturk approach of now it's time to modernize because I say so. I think that is going to backfire.
So if material forces, which seem to be a factor to, you know, be reckoned with in this case, is a driving force for somewhat of a modernization, what are your thoughts on foreign aid towards these countries that, for example, Sweden is a very generous giver, so to speak?
You know, foreign aid is a double-edged sword. And I wonder, look, if we were to invest money from rich countries in poor countries to build an infrastructure for education, and maybe even, you know, take up some of these cultural issues and say, this is where, these are our spending priorities. You could see a future where that leads to change. But right now, a lot of this money, it goes to waste. It only goes to reinforce what's already there. It just disappears into all sorts of corrupt organizations and non-governmental organizations. So the governments that are taking the money have bureaucracies that are hugely corrupt. And then you have the non-governmental organizations from the West that are also corrupt in their own way. And so I don't have a lot of faith in Western aid. And then to make matters even more complex, here in the United States, our State Department is investing money in gender fluidity. Now that takes us to a place, where I think in the Arab world, in the Muslim world, I'm not quite sure that we're waiting for that sort of giving and proselytizing. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to see a pride parade in Kabul anytime soon, no?
No, not soon. But, Ayan, if we would talk more about the way forward, so to speak, I heard you on Ivar Arpi's podcast and also on Kvartal when you mentioned that basically that there are certain values that the host countries of the host country that the immigrants need to adopt or otherwise leave, more or less. Like there are some values that are just like take, not give and take. And that we need an honest relationship between the host country and immigrants, as you describe it, and to absorb them into some sort of value system. How I interpret you saying it is that of a liberal democracy and liberal values, for lack of a better term, maybe. So you talked about like maybe halting migration and assimilation of people who have come here and repatriation of offenders, basically. Is that a correct summary of your views about about the way forward?
It is. And I think hidden into or packed into everything that you said now is, I would say, it is a give and take. And here's where the give comes. There are a lot of people who, when they take part in the debate on immigration and integration, simply say, you know, we don't fit. Their culture doesn't fit into ours, and we'll never be able to assimilate these people. Let's just deport them. Let's close the door. let's close the borders. I don't take that position. My position in the give and take is that the host society, if we were to have a very honest and transparent conversation, then we would know that some of the young men who come have no clue, as you described, Omar, earlier, because they come from societies where the relationship between men and women is radically different. And then on top of that, if you look at places like Syria and Iraq, and Afghanistan, and Somalia, I mean, increasingly large swaths of the world, order has broken down. So it's not even, you know, like, even what was there before, even though that wasn't so great, but it isn't there anymore. So there are, if I take Somalia as an example, if you were born in 1991, you were born in a context of complete anarchy. There's no tribal order, there is no Islamic order, there's no order, period. It's just chaos and violence. And if you come from a place like that and you come into Sweden, I think it's justified to assume, okay, so you haven't had any kind of, you know, socializing in the norms and values of a peaceful society. So the host society, the society that has given you the residence permit, the refugee status or citizenship, I think they should then provide the knowledge that you need, the tools that you need to acquire these social norms and values. Now, then it's up to you as an individual to show up for these classes, to take what you have been offered, use this opportunity. If you refuse to do so, and here's, I think, where I believe in individual agency. If you've been given all of this, and so you're rescued from a country that's in chaos, you've been given a residence permit in a new society, peaceful society, you've also been offered these tools of how to get these norms, and you reject all of that, and you go around harming people, then I think it's justified for that society to say, for this particular individual, you have no place, you have no reason to be here. You can go back to where you came from. And in that, I think it's a much more honest, and people would say it's transactional. Yes, it's transactional, but it is honest and straightforward, and you don't spoil the opportunity for those individuals who actually want to and who are craving a life in a peaceful society. Now, there are some societies that have in Europe that have had or have these conversations, and their problems are, the challenges are similar, but the problems they have with integration are not as big as, say, Sweden's. So Sweden is in a place where, you know, it's just this head in the sand approach to immigration and the negative consequences of some of these cultures. It has taken Sweden to a place, I mean, you live there yourselves, you know, it's weird to say it this way, but for a country like Sweden right now, I don't think it makes any sense to say, okay, let's go get some more people from the Middle East.
Well, there we are in agreement.
Yeah. When the problems are as big as they are.
Yeah.
Yeah, Ayana, I have been reading some reviews of your book in the Swedish media. And the journalists here are a bit careful. I mean, they basically want to say that you're an Islamophobic person, but, you know, because of your skin color and your former, because you come from the Islamic community, they seem to take another creative. they say that you're an Islamophobic person in other creative ways, if you understand what I mean.
In a Swedish way.
Have you noticed that in where you're now in other parts of Europe when your book came and how the reviews has been?
Yes, absolutely. And I expected that. In fact, I'm pleasantly surprised that the whole book wasn't simply dismissed as, you know, Islamophobic, whatever, you know. And they, some of them don't even have to be creative about that. Here's when we were talking about the problem of give and take, is if the leadership, and when I talk about leadership, I'm talking about politicians, I'm talking about members of the academic world, journalists, if they continue on this path of denial that, you know, anybody who addresses these issues is somehow bigoted, whether they're Islamophobic or xenophobic or this or that, these are all tactics of trying to avoid the subject. If they continue in this way, then I'm afraid, I think these problems will just get bigger and bigger. When I said I'm pleasantly surprised, what I mean is, especially with this book in Europe, so in the German-speaking world, in Sweden, in the UK, I'm finding that, in fact, Denmark, that there's more openness to talk about the problem. And the reason that this openness is there is not because of the book. It's not because of me. It's not because of people like you, Mustafa and Omar. It's because it's becoming impossible to hide from these problems. These problems, in the book, I only talk about sexual misconduct perpetrated by some immigrant men, but they were sort of limited in working class neighborhoods. Now they're spreading to middle class neighborhoods, and they're spreading to places outside of the large cities and into the suburbs and beyond. And it's not only sexual misconduct. There's also all sorts of crime and grime. And the cost of the negative, the unintended negative consequences of immigration from the Middle East, Africa, and South Asia is something that many of these European countries cannot pretend doesn't exist anymore. So the voices, the people who write these types of reviews and who say everybody is Islamophobic or afraid of immigrants or whatever, their voices are now less strong than they were 10 years ago or 20 years ago.
Ayan, do you think there is a justification for even dealing with a term such as Islamophobia? Is that really a thing, in your view?
Of course it's not. And you know that. Islam is a religion. It's a set of beliefs. And to criticize it, to scrutinize it, is not phobic to begin with. We never talk about Christophobia, even though there is Christians are persecuted hugely in Muslim-majority countries. Yeah. In the country Egypt, I mean, you know the plight of the Coptic Christians, but we never use the word Christophobia. And another aspect of it is phobia is a word to describe irrational fear. If you're a woman, it is not irrational to fear Sharia law. If you are like me, an ex-Muslim, it's not irrational to fear that a Muslim fanatic will actually attempt to take your life for no other reason than that you left the religion. Given the number of terrorist attacks and plots that we've seen and continue to see all perpetrated in the name of Islam, it's not phobic or irrational to, you know, to try and figure out which parts of it are actually Islamic, which ones are not, how can we understand this problem, calling for a reformation of Islam. That's not phobic. And so I think this word is just a way of, they're taking advantage of the postmodernist, climate, social and value climate that we live in now, where you can, you know, style yourself as a minority that's persecuted, and then that way avoid all criticism and shut your opponents down simply by claiming that the people who want to have a serious conversation about these problems have irrational fears or are bigoted.
Ayan, I agree with you that the term Islamophobia is a bit confusing, but do you think that we in Europe have some issues when it comes to anti-Muslim views and you know, basically like some kind of a phobia against Muslims. Is that justified to say?
No, it is. It's justified to say, and it is empirically true, that there are large numbers of the public in Europe who would rather not have Muslims as fellow citizens, as their neighbors or in their neighborhood. They don't want them in their schools. And the reason for that is more complex than people's, you know, the simple identity of being Muslim. And again, to reduce the number of people who feel this way, I prefer to have an open and honest and transparent conversation about it. If you have someone taking a truck and running people over, screaming Allahu Akbar, then I think you have to be honest in saying there is an Islamic component to that, but not every Muslim will do anything of the sort. That in fact, the majority of Muslims just want to go on with their lives and don't want to harm anyone. If there are issues of, I mean, you know better than me in Europe, but some of these conflicts, day-to-day conflicts, barely have anything to do with religion. It's people not getting along because their cultures are different. And, you know, when I was in parliament, most of the conversation was about, you know, immigrants from Morocco, some of them up to second generation. They would be overrepresented when it came to numbers in crime, school dropouts, the use of the welfare state. These issues are not necessarily Islamic or un-Islamic. These are cultural issues that I think, again, you keep going back to the issue of integration and assimilation. And I think that's really the healthy conversation we should be having.
Yeah.
Why are these statistics like this? For most Muslim communities who are immigrant minorities in Western societies, you can ask this question, and you know, my colleague and friend Ruth Copeman has written a book on this where he shows statistics for every community that identifies as Muslim in every Western country performing, you know, in much worse ways on all of these indicators compared to other immigrant minorities from non-Muslim countries. These are very good questions to ask and have an honest conversation about. And then I think if we can have these honest conversations, then we can think about solutions and policies.
Yeah. Ayan, you know, I'm trying to be like nuanced when I talk about Islam, especially if I hear somebody being, you know, like black and white. If they say something about Muslims or Islam, I'm trying to say, okay, so look, there's a difference between Islam and Islamism. And, you know, and those people are Salafis and those are conservative Muslims and those are moderate Muslims. But I can hear myself being like tired of my own voice, trying to explain these things,
and I can
hear the Swedish person in front of me just thinking like, I don't care about these nuanced views. I just wanted to stop. Like, first you come in our country, and now you want me to learn all these terms about these people. Like, just get rid of these issues. So how would you advise me to approach this issue?
I think honestly the time for trying to explain things away and define things away, that time is behind us in a place like Sweden, because the problems are so big. And I can completely understand and empathize with someone who's born in Sweden, a Swedish native, who says, I don't want to have any kind of nuanced conversation. Let's just stop the crime. Let's stop the crime. Some of the women I interviewed for the book, they made it very clear over and over again, I'm not anti-immigrant. I vote for left-wing parties. Those are the ones who are political. Many of them are completely apolitical. I want to welcome immigrants, whether they are Muslim or not. I just want the harassment to stop. I want the violence to stop. I think that's a reasonable request.
Ayan, if we talk about, like, again, the way forward and solving this problem and integration versus assimilation and so on, one can say that perhaps there can be two schools of thought in a way. One is having the immigrants adopting the values of the host country, and another school is having immigrants adapt to the values of the home countries. And this is perhaps you and I, Mustafa, sometimes we can differ a little bit, because I'm more for adopting the values, and I think you, Mustafa, see it sometimes as maybe non-pragmatic to think that way, and as long as they adapt to it and not break the law and so on. What do you think, Ayan, could be, how do you see this of adopting the values versus adapting to the values?
Of course, so now we're getting into these semantic waters, but I think it is a question of adapting and adopting, both of them. And I say this because, you know, I want to use the example that Omar gave earlier of when you were in Egypt and you were a young boy and you didn't understand, you know, what it was like to be around girls. And then fast forward, you come to Sweden and you realize you're in a completely different place and different norms and values and laws govern Sweden. And so after that insight, after those insights, you made a choice. You adopted those values.
It was a bit before, actually. It was connected to me leaving Islam.
Yes. Oh. Because then you were open. Yeah. You were open to, seeing the world in a different way.
Yeah.
But that, I think, in a sense, it is, you know, you've come to Sweden and you've adopted these this way of living. And to me, the word adapt, it's almost like, you know, getting used to the climate and that kind of thing. getting acculturated, but the outcome is the same. What I disagree with, and there's a third school of thought, and that is that integration or assimilation is a two-way path or a two-way traffic or whatever they call it, where the host society is expected to adjust to some of the norms and values that the immigrants bring with them. I saw Mustafa, I think, because you were translating from Swedish to us, this concept, you who have child rights. I don't know if you remember that.
You who is married to a child, I think, wasn't...
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
Huh. You who are married to a child. So that's the kind of thing I think that we should all be, especially those of us who are immigrant and a minority and who understand where that leads. That is the kind of thing that I think is absolutely wrong.
Right.
And it is the bigotry of low expectations. And what you do when you allow, you know, Sharia law or child brides, and when you say, well, polygamy, the guy has two wives, what am I supposed to do? And you just sit back and let it happen. You are excluding the protection of the Constitution and the law from the most vulnerable people, women and children.
Right.
And if that is your way of adapting or adjusting to immigration, then I think that's completely wrong and immoral.
Yeah.
And it doesn't get you what you want, which is what we've been seeing in the last, I don't know, 3 or 4 decades. European countries allowed Muslim households to oppress their girls and women. I'm talking about the girls and women who wanted to have different lifestyles, you know, go to school, finish school.
We have a huge problem with honor culture, for example, here in Sweden.
That honor culture, yeah. So these European countries allowed and betrayed these women and refused to protect them. And now look, because they thought they were buying themselves time, the women, Muslim women, were the sacrificial lambs. They thought the problem would go away. It didn't. And I worry more about this. You know, if you go look into the UK, these Sharia courts for that govern family law, they are so-called informal, but in fact, to a certain degree, they've been formalized.
Right. Yeah, I think the difference, maybe to clarify a little bit, perhaps about adopting and adapting, because it is more than just semantics, I would say. For example, I'm for, at least in the long run, that the immigrant population come closer to the Swedish population when it comes to values like gay rights, women's rights, and so on, that they themselves have to adopt these values as well. While maybe adapting would be more like this, like perhaps they would keep their values. For example, they would continue thinking that homosexuality is a sin, and as continue having maybe sexist views and so on, as long as they don't act out on them and they respect the law. And why I myself don't see adapting I see it actually as less pragmatic in the long run, because I don't see how there can be this clear disconnect between belief and action. For example, if you would have a community that's extremely homophobic, it's kind of naive that they would not act out on their homophobia. And the same thing, for example, when it comes to honor culture. We have laws against honor violence and oppression in Sweden, but because of the values did not change, honor violence and oppression continues to happen. I just wanted to clarify that part about adopting versus adapting.
And I'm grateful that you do that, because I think you really touch on where the difficulty lies, which is if people believe it's between their ears and they believe in these things, as long as they don't hurt other people, then they are entitled to their beliefs. But I agree that, and I see the problem that you point out, that it doesn't stay between people's ears, they do act on it. And there in liberal societies, I think you can draw a red line when it comes to behavior. And so the actual harming or curtailing the freedoms of other individuals because of your beliefs, that then becomes a matter of for law enforcement. But if you believe in, you know, we have, even in Sweden and in the rest of Europe, you still have populations who are homophobic and who are misogynist, but that's what they believe. And, you know, I think I see where it's very clear to me what you're getting at, but it's not clear to me how then we can make people change their beliefs. And I think the only path towards that, which is a very long-term investment, is in their education. And for a lot of immigrants, unfortunately, the education system has been, it's been less than good. These schools very quickly become so-called black schools, and then the host society, the school adapts to the norms of the immigrant members, and so they don't really learn much. And then they watch the television from the countries that they come from, they visit only the websites of the Middle Eastern countries. And so I agree with you, but I would say when it comes to changing people's hearts and minds, that's a long-term investment in education and other soft power means. When it comes to behavior, hurting someone, there should be a red line.
Yeah, I agree. And I think changing people's beliefs is actually quite difficult, but I have a more longer time perspective. So I'm more concerned about that the upcoming generations don't inherit these values and beliefs. So this is more my concern.
Yeah, and I think that's why when I'm seeing the newcomers traveling around and giving lectures, I'm more focusing on that they, you know, don't break any laws rather than they change their value system. I'm trying to be more pragmatic there, and hopefully that their children more, you know, adopt the value system. I think to tell people who come in Sweden that their value system that it's wrong or it's flawed, I think there's a chance that they will just don't listen to you, because you know values are sensitive issue, and if they will tell me, what are you talking about? I mean. I have a great value system when it comes to my family, to the love of family, relatives, my father, society. Like, well, what are you talking about? So I think I want to have good results, and I want people to listen to me rather than, you know, that they don't.
Let me share with you an anecdote. When I was a translator interpreter in the Netherlands, in asylum seekers centers, they used to have, they may still do, I don't know, but they had programs to talk to Somali women, and I was called as a Somali to translate from Dutch to Somali and back on female genital mutilation. And let me call her just a teacher, but the person who was giving the information, what they would do first was just simply describe the anatomy of the female, and then from there describe why mutilation is bad. And once they had done that, there would be the pushback from the audience. And this is, I think, Mustafa, where you are going to find that individuals respond differently to information. So the people who were imparting the knowledge were not really going on about, you know, saying we want to change your culture or your beliefs or your values. They were just saying, here is the harm that's caused with this damage to the anatomy of the female. And some of the women would respond by saying, I fully understand all the information that you've given me, but this is against my religion, or it's against my tradition, or it's just not how we do things. We reject this. We will continue to circumcise, that's how they call it, or purify our girls. Some of the women responded by saying, I had no idea that this was, and others responded different. And I had done this many, many times. And I found that the younger women were almost always keen to learn more, and they would extricate themselves from the room sometimes and cut away from the older women and say, tell me more, where can I find more information? So I think it's a mixed bag, and I would give both. I would talk about not breaking the law, but I would also start introducing these ideas, and then you just get their feedback and you'll be surprised.
That's great. Ayan, I would like to finish with asking you a last question about the future. So where do you see Europe in like 30, 40 years in the future? Worst case scenario and a better case scenario?
Yeah, exactly. We have to think in terms of scenarios. I think different countries will see different scenarios, because you can see places like Denmark, a small population, they have addressed these problems seriously. Here's what some of the things that I think. I think the countries that continue in this, what I call sticking your head in the sand approach to immigration, they might find themselves in a worst case scenario, like the Balkan countries, the former Yugoslavia, where you have faction against faction, and the extremes basically taking over, and anarchy and a rise in, you know, some of the aspects that you see in the developing world. You actually already see some neighborhoods like that in France. That's a worst case scenario, or a worst case scenario. Another scenario, I mean, you've all followed the process of Brexit. And a huge part in that debate was about immigration. And there are more countries that are part of the EU that feel this way. And so you have another scenario where you could watch the breakup of the EU, at least when it comes to the rejection of the freedom of movement. Another scenario that I see, a better case scenario, the best case scenario, would be for these EU member countries to get together and be honest about how big this challenge is and what it entails and the resources that are required to fix the problem for each country and to do it in an equitable way. I think this demonization of the countries where the, you know, people come, like the fast place where they come to, that has to stop. If that happens, then I think you could say maybe that would be the best case scenario, is that disaster is averted. There are people whom I have spoken to who look, but I'm not a demographer, who only look at demographics and say, well, Europeans are not having enough children. And immigrants that want to come to Europe are not from India and China, you know, the type of immigrants that we get in the US. The typical immigrant that comes to Europe comes from Africa, and actually you will see more and more Africans. And the Middle East and South Asia. And so within 50 years, purely because of demographics and because of fertility rates, you're just going to see a different kind of Europe. Now, I don't care if people look different, as long as they adopt the norms and the values of Europe. Europe will always be Europe. But if they reject those, and the process of Islamization continues apace as it is doing now in some countries, then I think those demographers' doom scenarios might just be what we see. But I always like to end on an optimistic note. And right now, I find the developments in Sweden and Swedish elite, the fact that they're actually sitting down and admitting that they have made mistakes and are talking about, in a rational way, talking about immigration and its consequences, that gives me hope for a better case scenario. And it's because of people like you. So the Swedes are really lucky to have immigrants like you.
Gotnitor, erajevlar. Tak foratni lisnar pozista moltit. Haen miket fin sugo sutvo.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.